And welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. We come your way every Saturday, 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific Time. We do stream live on the internet at richarddugan.com and newspress.com. We're rebroadcast Sundays from 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific Time on a2zen.fm. And we archive programs at richarddugan.com, the radio show's page. So you can go back and listen to and even download and re-listen to and share the programs with those who you feel would benefit from the information that we provide here on Tell Me Your Story. Today, we are going to visit with a good friend, somebody that I have been interviewing for, if my calculations are correct, I've been interviewing since before the turn of the century. And his name is Greg Braden, and I know that probably might make you feel a little old. It does me, considering I just celebrated a birthday. So there you go. How are you?
I am doing very well. I'm actually celebrating a birthday within 12 hours.
Well, congratulations. I
Thank
have
you.
To say that this is the birthday where I play with a full deck, and then it's all over. Now, you and I have talked for a good, I'm going to say 12, maybe even 14 years, going back to one of your earlier books, Zero Point, and even before that. And there's been a progression. And first of all, I would like to say, too, that it was a great pleasure to finally meet you in person at the Conscious Life Expo in February down in Los Angeles. It was great to shake your hand and at least say hello and have you put a name to a face to a name.
It was, Richard. And, those are very fast programs. They're very compact. And,
yeah.
Certainly don't get to spend as much time as I'd like with you. But, it was good to see a face with the voice that I've been working with for, I think it has been at least 15 years.
Yeah.
I would imagine, 12, 15 years.
Yeah, 1998, 99, something like that. But one of the things that was so compelling about what you shared, and of course you allude to this, of course, in Deep Truth as well, is an area that I haven't really gotten into in this program in the nearly 5 years that I've been doing it. It's a subject that I've kind of stayed away from, and you're starting to broach it a little bit, but from a very scientific perspective. Now, you have spoken on this program many times about man's existence prior to pre-6,000 years ago.
Sure.
And you have what seems to me pretty compelling evidence within your books to support that conclusion that this isn't the first go-around for us.
Well, absolutely. And it's actually been something I've spoken about often in the last 30 years. I guess it just depends on which conversation, which interview, which book we're
yeah.
talking about. But the topics of the books, Richard, I know you have mentioned in the past, each book is different from the others on the one hand. On the other hand, there's a through line that seems to bring them all together. And part of that through line is that each book helps us to understand a facet of our existence in an honest and truthful way. Excuse me, I think that's important because of where we find ourselves, the context of where we find ourselves in the world today. The most recent interview you and I did, we talked about the fact that we are living the greatest shift of power, of wealth, of resources in recorded human history, and it's requiring us to think differently, the greatest shift in thinking.
Yes.
In recorded human history, to come to terms with, to meet the challenges and the crises that we now face because of such a huge shift in paradigm. From my perspective, I don't know how we could possibly do that if we weren't honest about our past. And this is where the science, I think, comes in. What I've found, and I'm hesitating, I'm not sure how far back in time we want to go here, but what I've found is that people throughout the world over the years, they're almost universally, there's a sense that we humans have been on Earth much longer than is acknowledged in mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
We've all heard theories and hypotheses and stories about ancient civilizations and Atlantis and Lemuria and all that, which may very possibly have existed. And I have to say, as a scientist, I have no scientific evidence to suggest that they did. So what I'm doing in this body of work is I'm doing my very best to stay with peer-reviewed science, what science is mm-hmm. is now accepting, and it's some pretty awesome discovery that science now is bringing to help have this information come full circle, full term.
Now, I want to stop you right there and have you address one comment you made in the talk that I thought was very profound, in the sense that you were talking about the missing link, but you made the comment that as a scientist, I cannot say that it doesn't exist just because they haven't found it. But it's been a long time that they've been looking, you know, and so how long do we give science to search for something before we say, well, it isn't there?
Well, here's the thing. There are two conversations. One is about civilization itself.
Mm-hmm.
And the scientific evidence is very clearly showing that advanced civilization now stretches back in time at least twice as old as what we've been led to believe in the past. So civilization itself, we're taught in our mainstream classrooms and textbooks. I went to school in the 60s and 70s. Many of our listeners were in school during the same time. Or if you have young people in school today, we're still being taught the same thing. And that is that civilization itself originated about 5,000 years ago during the time of ancient Sumeria and the Mesopotamian Valley in a primitive state, and that we have been on a journey, a linear journey, that now culminates with the sophistication of the world that we see today. So we've been taught that it's essentially a one-way journey from primitive to advanced. It's happened one time, and we're at the top of that journey. The evidence very clearly is showing now, it's pushing the date of advanced civilization back near the end of the last ice age, in a time that historically has been a little murky and a little misty when it comes to historians. So this is civilization itself. When it comes to humankind, there is something very similar that is happening. In 1859, I think most of our listeners are familiar with Charles Darwin. He published his first work on the origin of species by means of natural selection. Darwin believed in his time that all life originated from a single form and has evolved slowly, gradually over long periods of time, and that if we look in the right places, he believed that we would find the fossil evidence to support that theory. That theory became firmly entrenched in the late 1800s and early 1900s. And even today, scientists are attempting to fit the fossil evidence that they find in places like Tanzania and Olduvai Gorge, the Leakey Foundation, throughout Europe and the Americas. They're attempting to fit the discoveries that they find into this hypothetical tree that Darwin proposed in the late 1800s. Even though the physical evidence doesn't support it, and even though now the DNA evidence clearly does not support these relationships. So there are two things. One is civilization itself, and the other is humankind. What the fossil evidence is very clearly showing is that what we call modern human, anatomically modern human, that's us, we showed up on Earth about 200,000 years ago. We're not sure where we came from. As a scientist, I don't know where we came from, but what I do know is the Darwinian story of where we came from doesn't fit what the evidence now is telling us. So we showed up about 200,000 years ago. If you were to place a skeleton of an anatomically modern human from 200,000 years ago next to ours, for all intents and purposes, you can't tell us apart. Body proportions are the same, brain capacity is the same, cranial capacity is the same. So we haven't changed in that 200,000 years, and that's not Darwinian evolution. So we cannot say with scientific precision where we did come from, but what we can say is the story that we're being required to share in the classrooms no longer is supported by the evidence. On the one hand, on the other hand, the teachers in the United States of America are being threatened. Many of them are losing their jobs if they offer alternative theories to the Darwinian idea. So there is, it's fair to say, there is a reluctance to share the new discoveries, and it's accurate to say that in some cases there is a resistance, an outright resistance to sharing the new discoveries that help us, I think, round out the way we think of ourselves and our relationship to the world.
So then science is going in the opposite direction than, say, a criminal investigation should go, where when you're a criminal investigator and you're gathering evidence, you allow the evidence to lead you to a conclusion, whereas we've accepted a conclusion, and now we're trying to force fit the evidence, i.e., a round peg into a square hole.
Precisely, and I'd like to say a word, excuse me, about science itself. I was trained as a scientist. I think the scientific method is good. Science is good. Science certainly doesn't have all the answers. There are huge gaps and glaring inconsistencies in the scientific story of us and our relationship to the world. But science can only be as good, Richard, as we allow it to honestly serve us. Science is a method of exploration. And science is designed to be constantly updated when new discoveries add to, or in some cases overturn, what we previously thought was the truth of our relationship to the Earth or ourselves or our past. And this is where the problem is coming in. Science has become a business. And for a number of reasons, power, money, ego, habit, there's 150 years of the scientific story that is being perpetuated in the Western world. And even though new discoveries now are showing us where that story is no longer accurate, we're being required by law to share that story. The obsolete science in the classroom, and here's what I mean by that. In the United States of America, and to some degree in other countries in the West, each teacher is bound by a covenant with the state within which they teach that determines what they can and cannot share in a classroom. So until a school board for a particular state approves the curricula that reflects the new scientific discoveries, the teacher is required by law to teach what's in the classroom, what's in the textbook, what is already approved. And if the new discoveries, these are peer-reviewed discoveries. This isn't New Age hypothesis or, you know, airy-fairy thinking. These are peer-reviewed scientific discoveries. They're accepted in the pure science circles. They're not accepted in mainstream pop science, in the media, in the documentaries, and certainly in the classrooms and the textbooks. So the net effect is that our young people are being taught a scientific story of our relationship to the Earth, to our bodies, to our past, and the way we solve our problems. They're being taught information that now, by definition, is no longer scientific. It's obsolete. So that would be important at any time.
Yeah.
And it's something that we should be concerned about at any time. But now, when we look at that within the context of where we find ourselves in the world today, the best minds of our time are very clear that this is no ordinary time.
Yeah.
In the history of our world, that we are, in fact, facing the greatest number of crises, life-threatening, future, civilization-threatening crises ever to face a single generation. And if we attempt to solve the crises through the thinking that's led to them, we know where that's going to lead because that's the world we have today.
Right, right.
It's the world of an economic system based upon the false Darwinian assumption of survival of the strongest. The corporate system is based upon survival of the strongest. It's a world that leads us to believe that we live in a world of scarcity and that we must fight one another for our piece of the pie. And that thinking is leading to the collapse of many of the systems, the economic system, the business systems. We're seeing the threat of a really large war in the Middle East. Now that is the culmination of many other wars over the years that are based upon this false assumption of survival of the strongest, false assumption of Darwin.
Interesting.
So this is why it's really important, it's vital now that we honestly and truthfully share with our young people and in mainstream media the deep truths of our existence that are being revealed by the best science of our time.
Now, you had also said in this conference that we attended back in February, and you've also referred to it in your book, Deep Truth, which is available through your website, gregbraden.com. You made the comment here about our educational system on this program just a moment ago.
Mm-hmm.
And as we're sitting there listening to you in the conference, and you shared that same basic information, my wife turns to me and she says, well, then where are we supposed to go to get this education? So I put that question to you. If we really want to know the truth, where do we go?
I'm going to begin by saying it's not the teacher's fault. I want to be very clear. I'm not criticizing the teachers in the West. Their hands are tied to some degree. This book is released, Deep Truth. The title of this book comes from a statement that Niels Bohr made in the mid-20th century. He said it is the hallmark of any deep truth, and in this case, a scientific truth, that its negation is also a deep truth. So when we find new discoveries that overturned what we used to think was the deep truth or deep truths of science, then the new discoveries themselves become the new deep truth. So this is what we're referring to. And the book was released October of 2011. And one of the first things I found, Richard, I've been on tour all over the world, is that teachers are coming out of the woodwork all over the world asking me to come to their classroom to share this information. You know, I couldn't possibly go to every classroom that I'm being invited to, but it tells me that there is an opening and an openness. Teachers are asking for ways to share this information.
They're asking for Professor Braden.
Well, the textbook itself is, I mean, the book Deep Truth has become a textbook on the university level. There's an engineering course that just begins next month in Calgary.
Wow.
Based upon this the information in this book, and middle schools throughout the states, many teachers they can't use the entire book. What they're doing is they're picking bits and pieces with the peer-reviewed evidence, and they themselves are going to their school board to get permission to share these new discoveries. So it is changing.
Right.
And the young people themselves that know of the new discoveries are now going into the classroom and saying to their professors or to their teachers, what about this? And then they give them the peer-reviewed documentation. Then the teacher has to look at this and go back into the school board and update their stories.
Right.
So it is changing.
Okay.
And like I said, it would be important at any time, but what we're being told is for the next 12 to 18 months, huge decisions are being made in our nation and in our world that will determine the fate, literally the fate of civilization, whether or not we have a global collapse in our economy, whether or not we have a war in the Middle East that pits the East and the West against one another on a global basis, how we deal with climate change, diminishing resources, the food, our ability to grow food and share resources. These kinds of things are all being determined over these next 12 to 18 months. If we attempt to solve the problems and propose solutions based on the way of thinking, the false assumptions that led to the crises in the first place, they're probably not going to be very effective.
Yeah, yeah.
And so this is where we find ourselves today. So in answer to what your wife is saying, I think it's up to us.
Yeah.
There are a lot of reasons. I mean, you think there's 150 years, Richard, of a scientific story that's been perpetuated about our relationship to our bodies, how healing occurs, what disease is all about, our relationship to the past, how long we've been here, what we know, about cycles of time and cycles of climate change and all of that. 150 years of a scientific story that has been perpetuated, and it takes a lot of money to change that story, to go back and change hundreds of thousands of textbooks.
Yeah.
The habit of professors who have been teaching 30 or 40 or more years, to ask them to change their curricula, to update this new information. And I understand, I fully understand the challenges that these things represent. And I also think we owe it to ourselves and our young people to be honest.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I'm not saying that we need to replace everything that we teach today with the new information. My sense is, from being with the young people and being with the teachers in the classrooms, and researchers. I mean, we're not talking about, you know, young people. We're talking about researchers and people, politicians, lawmakers, who are being asked to make the decisions. I think the thing to do is to allow the new information to stand beside what we already know to be true, so that we have a full toolbox. We have all the information so that we can pick and choose, and common sense has to come in here as well. So, this is where we find ourselves today, and fortunately the new book, Deep Truth, it's being accepted very well. It goes into paperback in October of this year, and the pre-sales orders for the paperback, if they're in any indication of the popularity of this information, then I think we'll be seeing a lot more of this information in the classroom and in the mainstream, in the documentaries.
When we come back from our break, I want to ask you about the scientific aspects. You're the researcher, and you've investigated a lot of this. I want to talk about, in more in-depth, about the human being, and more specifically, the human being's DNA and its relationship to all of this, because there's a piece of that puzzle that we want to kind of bring out as well. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan. My guest, Greg Braden, author of Deep Truth, available through his website, gregbraden.com. I'm Richard Dugan. Stay right where you are. And welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm here with Greg Braden, and we're talking about not only Deep Truth, but a lot of other issues regarding humanity. And quite honestly, I think, Greg, maybe our own survival as a species. Matter of fact, I've heard it said on numerous occasions, both by myself and other people, that humans are the only species on the planet that could self-annihilate. There's no other species on the planet that has the capacity to do that in and of itself. And to that end, I'm curious, you talked about Darwin's theory, and you made a very strong point that the phrase that most people remember from Darwin is survival of the fittest, which is incorrect. It's survival of the strongest.
Sure. I just want to say a couple words about Darwin, just so people are clear. I'm not a Darwin basher.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Any sense of the word? You know, Darwin was a scientist.
Sure.
And I think he was probably a pretty good scientist. 1859. It was another world in 1859. And Darwin attempted to do something in his time that had never been done before. Prior to 1859, the big questions of our existence: where does life come from? Where does human life come from? What is our relationship to our bodies? What's our relationship to the world? How do things work around here? How do we solve our problems? Those questions were answered largely by the church, by the religious community and the church. So Darwin was the first scientist that attempted to apply the rigors of science to answer these questions. And he himself said, Richard, if you read his, our listeners, if they read his work, and I've highlighted this in the book Deep Truth, Darwin expected that his theories would fall. He said, my theories aren't the end of all ends of these theories. He said, they're a stepping stone, a bridge to get us to the new information, as new discoveries come along. So Darwin expected that his theories would fall. It's a mainstream that will not allow his theories to fall for a number of the reasons that we've already spoken here. So I think Darwin, in my opinion, where Darwin went wrong, where he made a mistake, was he took some observations that he made for some forms of life in some parts of the world, and he tried to apply what he saw in those places to all life everywhere, including humans. And the problem is that the data simply doesn't support that assumption. The data doesn't support that theory. And, you know, Darwin could not possibly have known in his time what we now know in ours. He didn't have the opportunity to look inside of a cell. He didn't know about DNA and about, you know, genetic codes, for instance. So this is where the theory is really beginning to break down. And it's beginning to open the doors to a lot of possibilities. We don't know exactly who we are, where we came from, but we know who we're not and where we didn't come from.
Okay.
So I think it's interesting.
So can we talk about that in reference to our human DNA? There are aspects of it that we can link to some of the other species on the planet. So in other words, there is a linkage of some sort to other beings that live here on this planet.
Sure.
Other animals, if you will.
That's but true of all DNA.
Right.
All DNA appears to be related in one form or another. What happens with humans, Darwin's theory of evolution said that changes would come slowly, gradually, over long periods of time, and that the changes would appear only when they were required for survival. The term in biology is that nature never over-endows. So in other words, nature doesn't provide a thumb and an opposing finger until that need arises.
Or I see.
Nature doesn't nature doesn't provide overkill on brain capacity unless there's a need for that brain capacity.
Right.
And this is where the whole concept of humans, we do share DNA with all forms of life. We share it with a fruit fly, with worms, with bees, with every form of life. The evolutionary family tree of humans that is popular today, if we go online or look in a textbook, it shows Homo sapiens at the top, and it shows a lineage of beings that are believed, the scientific community suggests, that they are the predecessors, the ancestors to where we are today. So when I was in school, most of our listeners, we were in school, we were taught that, for example, Neanderthal is an ancestor of ours. In 1987, there was a discovery I talked about in the live program, probably in the program that you had the opportunity to see.
Mm-hmm.
There was a discovery in Northern Europe that should have made the front page headlines all over the world, BBC, CNN. It was relegated to a few scientific journals. What happened was, in a cave under the earth, a Neanderthal infant, a baby girl, was discovered in a never-before-seen state of preservation. It hasn't happened before. We've never seen it since. But this single Neanderthal baby girl was found in a cave. She was carbon-dated to about 30,000 years old. And she was preserved so well. Her skin, her fingernails, her hair was preserved so well that her DNA was extremely well preserved. And for the first time, we had the DNA of a being that is supposed to be our ancestor 30,000 years ago to compare to our DNA today. The work was done at the Human Identification Center in Glasgow, Scotland, where high-profile CSI-type cases are processed. And the results were not published until the year 2000. In the year 2000, they were published in the very prestigious journal Nature. And the bottom line, the last sentence of the last paragraph, the conclusion, says the results suggest that modern human was not, in fact, descended from Neanderthal, because there's not enough overlap between our DNA and their DNA. So they're not our ancestors. And as a matter of fact, the work was showing that we probably shared the earth with them. We walked the earth with Neanderthal, so we couldn't have descended from Neanderthal. So now we know who we're not. We're not the descendants of Neanderthal. And if you look at the family tree, they're still there. They're pushed them way out on the side. They're calling them a cousin now. But where this mystery really shows up is that the DNA that separates us from other primates, that gives us our human characteristics, a lot of that is focused around a human chromosome number 2, a very mysterious chromosome. There are entire conferences that are held for a week at a time on human chromosome 2. It sounds like a really interesting conference. To someone, hey, honey, I'm going to the human chromosome 2 conference, in Europe for a week.
Riveting.
Hey, riveting, absolutely. But what the researchers have said is that the genes that give us our human characteristics that we find in human chromosome 2, they have come together through a fusion. It's called a telomere-to-telomere fusion. That could not have happened under natural conditions. In other words, it's not the product of a natural evolutionary response. Something else has happened. And the geneticists have to stop there because they don't know what it is, and I don't know what it is. But what we do know is that Darwin's idea of evolution breaks down when it comes to modern human, when it comes to us.
Okay.
As a geologist, and I was trained as a geologist, and I worked in the industry before I became a defense engineer. What I have to say is that evolution is a fact in the geologic record for some forms of life. We see it for plants, we see it for animals, and we see it for some primates. But something happened, Richard, 200,000 years ago. We don't know what it is, but that something is where we appeared, and we don't see a link between us and those beings that preceded us. And whatever it is that happened, the geneticists themselves are saying could not be the result of natural selection as Darwin described it. So I don't know what did happen, but Darwin's idea of evolution doesn't describe us, because we suddenly had a cranial capacity much larger than was appeared to be needed. We had the ability to stand up. We had the ability to reason. We had the opposing digits. And we haven't changed since that 200,000-year appearance, and that is not Darwinian evolution.
Exactly.
Now, there are other theories that are called punctuated evolution that says evolution happens in not gradually over long periods of time, but it happens in spurts. Stephen Jay Gould proposed this theory. It's a good theory, and it may explain some other forms of life. It doesn't explain what happened to humans. So I think, to be honest with young people today, alongside Darwin's theory of evolution, we could share with them the new data that doesn't support it. And until we understand clearly what happened 200,000 years ago, we're not going to have the answer where humans come from. But what we do know is that there appears to be some form of design, and you have to be very careful when you get into the language,
right?
Because there are so many implications surrounding that. But there appears to be a design rather than a random occurrence. And the DNA is where this is really becoming apparent. DNA is a code. And the way the code is set up that makes us who we are, it couldn't have happened in an incremental fashion unless all the code was there so that all the systems could function. The organism wouldn't have survived. So let me just give you an example. If we had a cell that learned to eat but never learned to excrete, that cell wouldn't last very long, because there would be no way to eliminate the byproducts and the toxins once it had eaten.
Right.
So that's an example of something that both systems had to be in place simultaneously, the ability to eat and the ability to excrete. Or another one, hemoglobin and the ability for blood to clot. If a cell developed, or a being were to develop, for blood to clot, there are 40 proteins that must be in place. And if any one of those is not in place all at once, when there's an injury, the blood simply won't clot, and the wound will bleed and bleed and bleed until the being bleeds out. So the ability to have that clotting mechanism had to be in place when the being or the organism was developing as well. It's not something that could have happened over a long period of time. So, I mean, those are just a couple of examples.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll talk about this in detail in the book, and there are some very good references to the geneticists that are working with us, and it is a genetic mystery. Human chromosome 2 is a mystery.
Well, I think one of the fascinating questions that has been in conversations that I've had with people, and my wife is a font of curiosity and questions in light of a lot of this, and she made a very interesting observation about humans as a species in comparison to all the other species on the planet. And her basic statement had to do with the fact that humans don't belong on this planet. All you have to do is take a look at every other species on the planet, and it has physically adapted in whatever time frame and in whatever way to the environment in which it lives. Polar bears do not live on the equator, and iguanas don't live in the Arctic or Antarctic circles.
Sure.
But human beings have managed to scatter themselves all over the planet, but they physically didn't adapt. They had to build structures, and they had to gather and create clothing to cover themselves in the cold areas, and so on and so forth. And her perception, and I kind of agree with her, is if we were created for this planet, we should be able to adapt like the other species of the planet.
Well, if we did, it evolved from existing species on the planet.
Yes.
Precisely.
Exactly.
You made a statement early on that I wanted to capitalize on, and it ties into what we're talking about here. Biologist, evolutionary biologist, Elizabeth Sartoris, Bruce Lipton, brilliant minds, are very clear, and they are all in agreement with the fact that there have been five great extinctions biological extinctions on planet Earth in the past, and that we are right now, we are deep into the sixth great extinction, and that humankind is part of the life that is threatened through this extinction. The number of species that are becoming extinct on an annual basis, and the inability of the ecosystem to support forms of life, a lot of it's due to the destruction that humankind is has created on the ecosystems. We I had the opportunity to tour. Have you had Bruce Lipton on this program?
I have not had him yet. I'm working on that. I'm hoping to.
He's a dear friend. We toured Europe together for a couple of weeks. A lot of train time, so we got to talk. And I asked Bruce on a long train ride. I think we were going from Austria to Munich. And I said, Bruce, you're an evolutionary biologist. How bad is it, really? I mean, you know, how bad are we in terms of this sixth mass extinction? And he said, I'll put it this way. He said, in the past, those that don't learn to adapt become mulch on the planet. So he said, either we learn to adapt or Mother Nature will turn us into mulch.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was, I mean, you know, he had a glitter in his eye and a smile on his face when he said that, and I know what he meant. If we don't get our act together and figure out that we're part of the natural world rather than separate from it, and if we don't learn to integrate rather than trying to dominate, you know, we're in big trouble. And I think most of our listeners probably know that.
Yeah, some would argue that it doesn't matter where we come from; we're here, and we've got to deal with what we've got.
You know, one of the interesting things, though, Richard, in addition to the science, I've spent the bulk of my adult life searching in some of the most isolated, remote, pristine places remaining on the Earth today that have been least disturbed by the modern world for records of our past from our indigenous ancestors that have been preserved for you know, many thousands of years. And as different as the traditions are from one another, as different as the Aboriginals are in Australia from the Andean traditions in southern Peru and Bolivia, from the mountains and the deserts of the Sinai Peninsula in Egypt and the monasteries there and the monasteries in the highlands of central China and Tibet, very different cultures. But there are common themes that we find in all of these traditions and all these cultures, and one of them you've already mentioned in this program. And that almost universally, our ancestors say that we did not originate in this world, but we're visitors here. And they've got a lot of stories about where and how that happened. They're not necessarily supported scientifically, and I'm not sure where they fit in the scientific story, but I think it's very interesting that it is so universal, the fact that that our ancestors said, you know, we're not from around here.
It's a theory, obviously, that people are proposing, and of course there are many programs on the various channels that go into this, ancient aliens and the hybrid theory and so forth and so on. And I have to be honest with you, I can't discount it because there's too much, especially in what we've talked about here, there's too much evidence to at least support the consideration of that theory, considering that the other theories have washed out.
Well, I think we're going to have some resolution to those theories in the very near future. I don't discount the fact or the possibility of life from other worlds being a part of what we are here. But the new, and this goes back to the book Deep Truth, and what the archaeological evidence is showing very clearly, Richard, is that civilization is cyclic, advanced civilization is cyclic, that cycles of civilization go through cycles of war and peace, for example. 5,000 years ago, our ancestors said we would enter a cycle of darkness, a cycle of war, a cycle of suffering. It would last until the end of this 5,000-year cycle, which is the end of this year, the end of 2012.
Right.
And that is based upon Earth's position in space and very precise alignments that we can confirm with the computer. So our ancestors knew the Earth's position in space would change every 5,125 years. When it did, it would change conditions on the Earth. That would change the way we live. It would change our climate. It would change our weather. It would change our ability to grow food. we'd be forced to choose as to whether or not we fight one another in a model of scarcity, or whether or not we cooperate and follow nature's model of cooperation. And they knew that. They also said that the cycle before ours was a cycle that they called the Golden Age. They said it was a cycle of peace. And the reason I'm saying that is because the archaeology is showing very clearly all of the advanced archaeological sites prior to 5,000 years ago. So we're finding them in Turkey, we're finding them in Egypt, in Africa, in South America, and other places. But all of the sites, there's a mystery, and the mystery is that no weapons have been found, no evidence of large-scale war to solve our problems, no evidence of the need to defend cities with walls or with moats, no large-scale graves, no mutilated bodies that we find throughout history after great wars have happened. So the story from our ancestors is that we came from an era of peace, 5,000 years, a golden age where we learned to work together. We entered into this cycle of darkness, and now we are emerging, and whether or not the next cycle is one of war or peace is a choice that's being made right now. So the reason I'm saying that is because it may be, I believe that we're probably not alone in this universe. But a lot of times when people talk about E.T., I think that the E.T. may be something even more amazing than we've even let ourselves believe. And here's what I mean by that. During the Cold War years, only two superpowers had the technology and the money to go to the moon. That was the United States and former Soviet Union. And there were agreements made during that time. They didn't share everything that was found on the moon. Now, new superpowers are emerging. They're on their way to the moon, and they don't have those agreements. China, India, for example, both have active space programs, and they're on their way to the moon. And they both have said whatever they find there, they're going to share with the world. My sense, and the data suggests that there is archaeological evidence on the moon in the craters. The photographs suggest that, and there's, you know, we could do a whole program about that.
Mm-hmm.
But when people hear that, immediately they say, okay, aliens, ETs, which could be possible. My sense is, however, it's something even more profound. I think what we're going to find when we go back to the moon is those archaeological sites are us from another cycle in time where the technology allowed us to work together as a global civilization and explore things like the moon. It's written on the temple walls. It's written in the text. The oral traditions have always said that. Just science is discounted because it seems so outrageous. But I think when we look at that, we may very possibly find that it is us from another time that's also responsible for the way life has evolved in this world as well. And that opens up a whole realm of possibilities. So, and I also think it may be the catalyst that shakes up the way we think of ourselves in this world. And if we can look as an earthly civilization and we say, here is the archaeological evidence of advanced civilizations 15,000 years ago from the earth, and that's what we achieved then, how far could we go now if we can transcend our differences and work together? And if we can honestly share the discoveries in that way, that may be a catalyst that brings us together in ways that, that we've only imagined in the past. So the science cannot explain why we're here, but the science may actually, as it stands today, but the science may actually fill in some of the missing pieces that gives us an understanding that comes completely out of left field. And it'll be interesting to see where that goes.
It will indeed. I am actually rather intrigued and excited about the prospects of what they may find. And indeed, if you know, they are us, as it were. I think that it's this whole conversation, as we have been talking here on this program, is one in which, again, we're, you know, you in particular, especially with the the multiplicity of books that you've put out, and the information, especially in Deep Truth, which is just extraordinary, it's fostering, I think, also a new way of thinking so that we can then start making those different choices, those new choices to solve the issues that we have to face, the challenges that we have ahead of us. Now, here we are in the middle of, halfway through 2012, and I'm sure that we will probably talk at least one more time between now and the end of the year. And I remember asking you before, and your answer to the question, Greg, are you pessimistic or optimistic about our future? And you have always said you're very optimistic. You still hold that?
Oh, absolutely. I've never been more optimistic about our nation, about our world, and the reason is this. For 150 years, we're living in a civilization that was based on false assumptions of science. We've been led to believe that we're separate from one another. We're separate from our bodies. We're separate from the earth. Civilization is a one-way deal, linear. We're at the top, and that we live in a world of scarcity, dog-eat-dog, where we've got to struggle for ourselves, and there's only so many pieces of the pie to go around. The world that we live in today is the consequence of that way of thinking, and the systems that are breaking down before our very eyes are breaking because they are unsustainable systems based on false assumptions. So that the global economy that is breaking right before our eyes right now is based on a false assumption, a false Darwinian assumption of survival of the strongest. The way that the corporations have been integrated or not been integrated, the way that they have been executed, I guess, the idea of the corporation is not necessarily a bad idea. It's the thinking behind it. It's the thinking, the fear of the greed and the scarcity behind it that has become the problem. The way that we're dealing with diminishing resources. We're being asked, are we going to share them? Or are we going to fight for our slice of the pie and let everyone else fend for themselves, we being the modern technological world?
Yeah.
All of those things that are breaking down, because they're breaking down, there's an opening for new possibilities that simply could not have occurred when the systems were so firmly entrenched. And I've got to tell you, I've been in conferences with political people as well as religious and scientific leaders. It probably doesn't do any good to mention any names, but people who have believed in the past, they had a handle on what was going on. Even they're saying something, it looks out of whack. You know, they said there was a time we thought that we knew what was going on, and the term they use is awry. They say something has gone awry,
mm-hmm.
and even we don't know what's happening or where things are going. And I think that is that's the missing link in this evolutionary process of civilization, is that the things that are no longer sustainable have reached the point where they are collapsing for that very reason. The weight of their unsustainability is what's forcing them to collapse. And because they're collapsing, we're now looking, and there is an openness to new possibilities I've never seen before. So I think we're going to be okay. I think we're going to go through some difficult times to get to that okayness. I'm also a realist. There has to be one generation, Richard, that lives in a world where we have learned to master the systems that we've come to trust and rely upon, and at the same time as we witness those systems collapse, before the new systems are fully in place, we must have the fortitude and the vision and the strength to build the new systems based on what we now know to be true without getting lost in the fear of the failing systems. And that's where we find ourselves today. That's this generation. We're being asked to do something new in the presence of living in both worlds simultaneously, and to do so without getting lost in the fear of the uncertainty.
Mm.
And I think it's no accident that
yeah.
those things are happening now. Maybe this is what our ancestors saw in 2012. They didn't say the world would end.
No.
They said that our way of life would end, anything that is not sustainable. They said the translations in the Mayan text, for example, said that we wouldn't recognize our world after we go through the transition.
Yeah.
They also said very clearly it wasn't about a date. not about December 21st, 2012. That just happens to mark an astronomical alignment on a calendar that gives us, it's like a landmark. So we know where we are in the cycles. But the cycle began, this cycle of change began in 1980. It's a 36-year window. It ends in 2016. We're over halfway through that cycle right now, and we're well into the changes that our ancestors saw in their visions. We're well into the melting of the ice, the rising of the sea levels, into fires burning out of control on multiple continents, multiple wars that are occurring, a disease that has no medical cure, taking lives of millions of people. We're well into those changes.
Yeah.
So, and I think we're doing a good job. There's also a lot of good things happening, good things. Mm-hmm. People are learning to take care of themselves. They're learning to become more localized in their communities, to take care of themselves in that way, with their food and their water and their needs and their education. And I think that is going to be the hallmark of this next cycle, is more localized rather than localized tying into globalized, rather than relying purely upon a global system to support us. You know, it makes no sense to have a huge carbon footprint from a 757 Boeing to bring strawberries from, you know, the tip of South America into North America when the time of year doesn't support the strawberries in our growing season.
Exactly.
So that kind of, and I'm not saying it's right, wrong, good, or bad. I'm just saying that those things that may have worked in the past, mm-hmm, are no longer sustainable in the presence of the changing world, and I think that it's the opportunity for us to embrace those things.
Well, I know just the other day I had a conversation with my best friend. We went through grade school, high school, and college together. And,
wow.
And he is going through what many people in this country especially are going through, where he's lost job after job, lost his home to foreclosure, lived in his car for a period of time. I mean, just going through the ringer. And of course, calls me and asking me for help, and you know, I'm wanting to help in any way I can, And I was talking with him yesterday, and he was sharing with me actually some good news, and certain things were happening, and it's like now he's sort of like in the right place at the right time, and things are starting to look up for him, and he just hasn't let go. I mean, he's persevering. And I think that's part of what you're talking about as well. But the one thing that I focused on with him, as I was sharing with him and talking with him, not only just the other day, but weeks ago, was you still live in your hometown. You still have friends. Most of his family has either moved away or passed away, but he made many, many friends. I says, you need to go to those friends and say, hey, I need to get back on my feet. I need a short time to do this. Can you assist me in that process? And so forth. And that's basically what's happened. We have to remember our connectedness to one another.
We do, Richard. And what I'm hearing, the story I'm hearing from you, I'm glad that he's doing, things are looking up, and I'm hearing that for so many people and from so many people. And the common theme I'm finding in those circles, and they're not just in this country. I've seen this throughout the world as I've toured this last year, is the world changed, Richard, and the systems that we became familiar with are no longer functioning the same way. The world changed, and nobody told us. Nobody came out with a media special or, you know, an official announcement and said, we no longer live in isolated economies. We no longer live with isolated technologies. And the way we've thought about money and careers and jobs of the past is gone. Nobody came out and told us that. So where people I see, people that are struggling the most, are those that are clinging to an idea of the world that they've known in the past, and they're trying to get back to that world. They're trying to get back to a world that no longer exists.
Yeah.
Those are the ones that I'm seeing that are suffering the most. And if I could leave our listeners with anything, I'm aware that our time is drawing to a close here.
It is, yes.
With anything, it is about a way of thinking. It's subtle, it's powerful, so please don't be deceived by the simplicity of the statement that I'm going to share. Based in the false assumptions of science, most of us have grown up in a Western world where we have been consciously or subconsciously programmed to ask the following question, and the question is this: what can I get from the world that exists? That's the world that we have all been raised in. What's in it for me? What can I get from the world that exists? If we can make the shift from asking that question into a new question, and the new question is this: what can I give to the world that's emerging? If we can make that subtle shift, that little shift in the way of thinking opens huge doors of possibility in terms of jobs, in terms of careers. I might give you case histories of how people's lives have turned around, and they and their families are now working together, working out of their homes, creating new viable things that their community needs. They get to work together as a family. They are supporting themselves, are no longer reliant on another corporation for their livelihood, and they feel good about what they're doing. And all they did was they asked that question: what can I give to the world that's emerging?
Yeah.
So that little shift, and I ask myself the same question all the time. It's an ongoing process.
Yeah.
Because for so many of us, even those that believe they're firmly on a spiritual path, and I have no doubt they are, but we are so conditioned, and it is ingrained into us so deeply that we live in a dog-eat-dog world, and that we must get whatever we can get from the world. When we ask, what can we give, it changes everything.
It absolutely does. Greg, I want to thank you so much for sharing your time in this hour with us, and also your books, your latest one, Deep Truth. It's available through your website, gregbraden.com. We are linked there as well. And again, I will be in touch with you and your people to have you on again before the end of the year, because I know that there's still so much more that we can talk about. And I think one of the keys is what you are doing and what we're doing through this program is we're trying to give people hope, possibility. This is not the end. REM had that great line in that song: it's the end of the world as we know it. What we used to know doesn't exist. We can't go back there. It's time to start looking forward.
Absolutely, Richard. And I think it's important to be honest and truthful. And in that honesty and that truthfulness, that is where we find what's real and what opens the door to the new possibilities. So I look forward to meeting you back here one more time before the end of 2012.
You got it. I'm Richard Dugan. Greg Braden's been my guest. Again, his book is Deep Truth, and we hope that you will check that out. Until next Saturday at the same time, love to Lal. And we are clear. Thank you so much, Greg. It's been great. I know you have to move on probably to another interview, so I will
one
let
more,
you go.
One more, but that was a... I think that was a good conversation.
I couldn't agree more. I loved it. And plus the fact that now I can go back to my wife and say, you remember the question about who are we going to get educated by? You.
Is your wife a teacher?
No, actually she's not, but she's a very curious individual. She just is constantly asking questions, especially of the nature in reference to she had a blast going down to the conference, especially and sitting in your presentation in particular.
Well, you know, if she or you or she, either one, if you're certainly welcome as my guest to come to any conference I can get a guest pass for anywhere in the world. In all honesty, that Conscious Life Expo, it's not the best venue. It's not the best place for us to have that conversation. It's a difficult venue to work in, and,
sure.
And I'm happy to be there.
Yeah.
But there are others, that really lend themselves. The Hay House events are beautiful events,
yeah.
And I always get guest passes for those. So
well,
if you and your wife would like to come, I'd be honored to have you as my guest.
Absolutely. And if they're down in the L.A. area or along the Central Coast,
you know,
or what have
actually,
you?
Actually, Pasadena. There's one in Pasadena coming up before the end of the year.
Oh, okay. Well, so, I will look into that, and I'll stay in touch with Lauren, and we'll put something together and make the trip down there. That'll be a lot of fun.
That sounds good, Richard. I look forward to it. Thank you so much for a beautiful interview today.
Oh, thank you very much. Have a great weekend.
You as well. Take good care.
You too. Bye-bye.